for now, just settling into your posture. Hoping my microphone is close enough to me here. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. I'm bringing the attention into the body. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. And first, just feel how you're holding your body. Whether there's any tightness or rigidity. Seeing how you're aligned, the spine and the neck and the head. So we want to find a place of balance in our posture. And we want to be able to soften and relax even as we stay upright and alert. You might just move the attention through the body, kind of a sweeping or scanning, fairly briefly, just checking in with any points of tension need to be relaxed, like the jaw, relaxing the jaw, releasing the shoulders, softening the belly. So there's a sense of letting go. Just feeling the body being drawn towards the earth by gravity. We can notice the body as a variety of different points of sensation. And we can also feel it as a single object that contains all those sensations. When we talk about sensations in the body, it's also important to notice the felt experience on the mood or emotional level in the body. And just to notice how you're feeling. It's not exactly sensations, but this subtle, I call it an energetic, somatic experience that indicates some mind state. Or some activity in the nervous system. So here we see right away the connection between mind and body. Really not a connection, but the integration really inseparable. So this examination of body and mood can just bring us, helps to bring us into the present moment, into our present moment experience, to really see it clearly. Sometimes we sit down to meditate and kind of try to go somewhere else. It's important to first be here, to just be with what is present. And then perhaps through intentional movements of awareness, concentration, mindfulness, we will go somewhere else. We will develop different mind states or moods. But we don't want to start with that effort, because that means we're already trying to suppress something, fix something, enhance something. So just start with what is, with a sense of acceptance, non-resistance. It's okay. Not perfect, but okay. And once we've established this presence, this acceptance, then we can start to guide the attention a little more, focusing on the breath as a concentration object. Connecting with the breath either at the nostrils, the touch sensation of air coming in and out. Or if it's more helpful to just feel the movement of the belly rising and falling with each breath. Your breath is subtle, largely a neutral experience, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So it doesn't attract our attention typically. We have to make a little bit of effort just to feel it. Even then, can be challenging to maintain or sustain our attention with the breath or minds are habitually caught in thinking, and so the mind often wanders. So this becomes another important element of our practice, how to work with the wandering mind. First of all, we want to try to be non-judging, not in a sort of argument with ourselves or criticism of ourselves for the mind wandering, just again accepting, but then gently coming back each time to the breath. So a kind of training of the attention to stay with the breath. The phrase, keep coming back, that we speak at the end of 12-step meetings really applies to mindfulness of the breath as well. Keep coming back to the breath. Besides simply coming back to the breath, when the mind wanders, it can also be useful to just notice the thoughts, start to see the patterns, the habitual fears or resentments, fantasies, plans, judgments. not getting caught up in analysis or kind of personal therapy, but just to observe, start to step away from, to even disidentify with these habits. To just see that they are just almost energies. The Buddha talks about outflows of the mind. Like these are just discharges of our brain. And yet we often let them run our lives. Seeing and disidentifying with these habitual patterns can help us to become free from those controlling forces. Let go, to have more clarity. So maybe that was a lot of talking. When I'm guiding meditation on Zoom, online, I tend to talk a little bit more. I feel like we don't have that sort of group energy of just being in a space together where you can just let it be quiet. I feel like I'm leaving people hanging out there in the cyber world. So I do think, you know, if you ever feel like it's too much, just mute. You can't mute me, sorry, but which would be great. But then again, why would you be here? But, you know, just turn off the sound or turn down the sound on your thing. Or if you're using earbuds, you can just take your earbuds out. I won't be offended. I don't think I'll be offended. I don't know. You never know what you're going to be offended by. As I said, you know, I got home last night and I thought, well, I really should look at what we're covering tomorrow in the class. And so I'm in step 11, as I said, we're in the section called Buddhist prayer. We just went through the Lord's Prayer, which some of you were here for, which was quite an adventure. We really went overtime. And I don't know if it was the topic or just what people's mood, but so this section, and as I looked at it last night, partly because I was tired from flying and traveling all day, I just kind of felt like, oh my God, this is like too much or crazy. And it's one of those topics that, you know, I'll get asked about. Is like, oh, well, you're the Buddhist 12-step person. Well, how am I supposed to pray? Kind of thing, you know, solve that problem for me. Kind of like, you know, sometimes when you're a meditation teacher, people treat you like the answer man, you know, put a quarter in and ask a question, get the print out of the answer. But it's interesting too, you know, reading this again, this that I wrote so many years ago. And look at maybe how my own thinking has changed, but I will say, I mean, a lot of what I see in here is my struggle, you know, to answer this question and to look at it, and I still kind of struggle with it a bit. And partly, I guess, you know, at the end of the day, as they say, I just don't think it has to be a problem. I think it's one of those things like people, you know, who resist, particularly if you have a struggle with God and everything, then you're kind of like, well, how am I supposed to pray? And you're just like, don't worry about it too much, you know, just kind of like see what happens, you know, check it out, try different things. Don't pray if you don't feel like it, you know, just don't, it's, I think maybe it's partly because like the step says I'm supposed to pray. So if I don't pray, I'm going to drink, or my sponsor said I'm going to drink. If I don't get down on my knees, I've never gotten down, never. Well, since I've been sober, I used to get on my knees all the time as a kid when I went to mass, but you know, I don't get on my knees to pray. So, and I've managed to stay sober for 36 years. So if anybody claims that you can't stay sober by, if you don't get on your knees, send them to me. And if they've got more time than me, then maybe they can, whatever. But anyway, I think there are a bunch of different ideas in this section, which I think are worth looking at. So we'll kind of go through them. This first idea is that one, as it says here, one way of understanding Buddhist prayer is as setting intention. This means making conscious and explicit our highest aspirations. A lot of times, as with the serenity prayer, I find this to be more like reminding myself of what is true. Hey, there's some things I simply can't change, so I better get over it. Prayer is meant to break through the mind's barriers of negativity and pain and open the heart. That's not a bad sentence, not, I think, worth repeating. Prayer is meant to break through the mind's barriers of negativity and pain and open the heart. So by using ritualized language, we remind ourselves that these are timeless truths, reliable words. So this is, I think, the first reason for using prayer, at least for me, which is like, I'm in this difficult space, and because I don't have any clarity in that difficult space, it helps me to take some language and speak it, whether silently or aloud, to remind myself, all right, like, you know, turn it over, or the serenity prayer, you know, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, you know. Or in Buddhist terms, and we'll get into this in the next section, may all beings be happy. Or, you know, this kind of phrase, language that is just like words that I know, that I've heard before, that remind me of how I want to be, even though in this moment I don't feel that, I'm not feeling that. So that, I think, is kind of that. I mean, for me, that's kind of the most important part of it, because when I'm meditating sometimes, and I get into a really difficult mind space, like I just space out and get into a negative thought cycle, I'll bring myself back sometimes with words. And the ones that I use a lot are held in the arms of love. I have that in my book, Living Kindness, Held in the Arms of Love. And it's just something I say to myself, like, I'm being held with love. And it's one of those things, you can just put your hand on your heart, you know. But James Barras likes to do this, put his hands on his face, you know, just touch yourself, you know, kind of a prayer, right? Just touching yourself. So in a way, what I'm talking about is like, snap myself out of the cycle, the negative mind state cycle, you know. Snap myself out with language. So the next sentence, though, still, sometimes these traditional forms of prayer can be limiting. So then I have this piece from Brother David Stendhal Rost, from his lovely book, Gratefulness, the Heart of Prayer, where he talks about how you can be sort of repeating these prayers rote, right? This is the other side where it sort of doesn't work, where you're just saying them because, like, I'm supposed to say these words, right? Just like very much for me as a child, that's kind of how it was, right? And then it's like, there's no life in it. And I think that's one of the things that alienates people then about prayer. And he talks about how, like, you can be saying these prayers and it doesn't mean anything. And then you're outside, but he says, like, watering the African violets. Okay. And all of a sudden you're just totally there with the flowers, and, you know, and present, you know, and that's more of a prayer. So what he's really pointing to then is mindfulness, right? Which is interesting, you know, to think of mindfulness as a kind of prayer. It's a nonverbal prayer, but, you know, why do prayers have to have words? I guess that's how we typically think of them. But I think loving kindness meditation, which I think is a prayer, is often done without words. It's done as a felt experience or a visualization, you know, radiating kindness over the entire world, says the Buddha. You know, radiating kindness, there's no words in that. It's just a feeling, a felt experience. Oh, well, here it says, prayer isn't just words, it's a state of mind, of sinking into the truth, into the meaning. Yeah. So that's what's vital, right? I had some, I used to teach this college course at St. Mary's College, Catholic College. And one of the students told me that after she learned mindfulness and started to practice mindfulness meditation every day in class, as we did, that when she went to mass, it was much more meaningful and powerful for her. to go to Mass, that she had much more of a like religious experience, which I thought was lovely. Then, as I say here, to believe that just repeating some stock phrases will bring results is magical thinking. And this is where, you know, we step into the real challenge. And I think where a lot of people, again, have a resistance. Or maybe they have a grasping, you know, oh, I've got to say these prayers and it's going to, you know, make that person recover from their illness, or, you know, it's going to solve my problems if I just repeat this prayer over and over. You know, and I mean, as I say that, I, you know, I immediately have a, you know, a somewhat sacrilegious thought about Buddhists who, you know, repeat a mantra 100,000 times. And my understanding of that is that it's concentration practice, ultimately. It's not, you know, saying these words is going to create some magic. However, and I address this in the next section, there's another way, you know, when we get into this question of like, does prayer work, which I think is one of the less useful things to think about in your life, but if you so choose, and people obviously do, because we know there's been like research on this stuff, supposedly, I don't know, research, and I always put that in quotes, you know, researching the mind is a notoriously slippery area. But, you know, in Buddhist terms, if there's anything that might create, excuse me, something we would call magical, it would be through very deeply concentrated states. You know, and we see examples of this in the texts, in the early Buddhist texts, and then there are contemporary Buddhists like Dipa Ma, who supposedly, you know, did things that were somewhat magical, like they say that she could move through walls and be in two places at one time. I don't know. I'm skeptical of things like that. But I just kind of feel like I don't need to know that. You know, it's one of those things where I could have an opinion. That would be really helpful. You know, is there life after death? Well, this is what I believe. Like, no, it really doesn't matter, like, what I believe. It's there. There's reality that's unknown, and then, you know, I can make something up about it. Nonetheless, okay, just to talk about this a little bit. You know, in these very deep states of concentration, there's a couple things about them. One critical thing about those states of concentration is that there cannot be even a whisper of craving or a whisper of ego or self. Because as soon as that arises, the concentration state, the purity of the concentration state, is corrupted. You know, this is a strange language, I guess, but it's really probably the most accurate language. And so, but what that means is that if there can't be a whisper of desire or a whisper of ego, then you can't be trying to get something. So that kind of goes against the whole idea of I'm praying to get something. So the only kind of impulse that can come out of that mind state, it can only be a very pure impulse that's driven by love and compassion. You know, there can't be any ego in it. So the idea that, okay, I'm gonna learn to concentrate really well so that I can get the stuff I want. Just, no, it's not gonna work. I'm afraid to even like open up for questions on this topic because I feel like, oh, what about black magic? You know, that's like, because that's what comes to mind. Why, wait a minute. And, you know, I don't know is probably the best answer I have for most of these things. So let me move on here a little bit. Try looking at the last section of the of this section. All right, I'm going to read this. I don't know what it says. What I think now is that if a higher power is in fact the ultimate truth, then we cannot be separate from that. So there's nothing outside ourselves to pray to. You could say that prayer to an external higher power doesn't make sense. However, most of the time we aren't living in awareness of ultimate truth, and pretending to be there doesn't help. It's more helpful to recognize that although we know there is an ultimate truth, at any given moment, we might not be able to experience that. Our minds are mostly caught up in duality. So it's more realistic to act from that place we really are than from some idealized perfection. So this is sort of responding to the idea of, now that I know that there's no God, why should I pray? And as I'm getting at here, it's like, yeah, maybe there's no God, but when you say those words to yourself, does it help you? That's kind of how I look at it. It's very practical, very, you know, pragmatic. Otherwise, all we have is this, quote, knowledge of ultimate truth, which is solely intellectual, and our hearts have no refuge. We can be left with a sort of existential loneliness. Yes, we can. The Buddha is always trying to pull us away from extremes of thinking, often giving answers that don't allow us to rest in any one way of seeing things. What this tells me is that it's okay when the heart yearns for some outside support to pray to, quote, God. For me, God is not a being, but more like praying to the universe or the Dharma. At that moment, I feel separate. So to express that with a dualistic prayer is appropriate. It's an expression of where I am in that moment. At those moments when I feel totally in tune with the universe, the heart open and flowing, there's no need to externalize God. My prayer is my being itself. To me, my spiritual life is meant to be a support, not an intellectual exercise. So God, as I understand him, can and should be whatever I need to be it to be at any given time. I don't have to answer to some logic or some rulemaking body. Just respond to what my heart is calling for in this moment. The end. I like that. I mean, I'm trying to like tell people to shut up and stop bothering me. Like, stop trying to figure this shit out. And like, you know, you're getting it all into your head. Just do what needs to be done for your heart, you know. And I think, you know, this is where so much of the conflict, if people have conflict around these issues, around God, around the steps, comes is in the head. And if we can let go of that, then you know, then it gets kind of, it's simple in a way. I mean, that, you know, nothing's really simple, but it doesn't have to be a mess. You know, it can be something that just what works for me. And it's interesting sometimes, like, to check in with yourself, like, right in this moment, how does it feel when I say God? Does it feel like warm and fuzzy, or does it feel like hard and alien? So I think for me, I don't think about prayer per se these days, but I realize that at times I kind of call upon, just as I said earlier on, call upon kind of phrases that just calm me down. Like sometimes I just say love, 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 just to calm myself down. Or breathe is a prayer, right? Just breathe. Or it's okay, I'm okay. or just let go, you know, all of those things are prayers to me, just ways of speaking and verbalizing a need, a felt need in a given moment. So I will open it up to see if there are thoughts or comments on this tricky topic. Hello, Deborah.
Good morning, Kevin. A while ago, I wrote my own third step prayer, something to say in the morning before I got out of bed. And no, I don't get on my knees. But lately, I've been changing it slightly. And I find that interesting. But then I go from rote, which was helpful to get in the practice of prayer. But I go to today, I need this, or, you know, I'm calling upon for assistance or to help me honor my difficulties or uplift my heart, whatever. But I find it interesting because the switch to extemporaneous was very innate and I didn't think about it. And I loved that. So thank you for talking about prayer today.
Yeah. Thank you. And what I appreciate is that you're talking about just respond, letting that evolve. Like it doesn't have to be like a thing, like this is the way it's done, this is the proper way to do it. It's like, because I think we're always evolving as spiritual beings and where we are, what our might not even have thought about, like, what do I believe right now? And then it's only when you hear a prayer that you realize, this is how I'm responding to that right now, even though I responded differently in the past. Thank you. All right, some more hands up. I guess Maureen. I'm not sure whose hand went up first, so.
Hi, I'm Maureen. Hi. Hey, Kevin. So I'm very new to this. So to me, like when I say those phrases of loving kindness to myself, like, may I be safe, may I be happy, or to me, that's a prayer. Mm-hmm. And I love those two last paragraphs you read on page 235, because, you know, my prayer is being itself. And I don't have to get all caught up in, you know, whether I kneeled and said the third step prayer and I'm going to stay sober or not. Yeah. But, you know, that I can be compassionate and kind and find that way. There's, I'm not sure who wrote it, but I heard it was, surrender to what is, let go of what was, and have faith in what will be.
Oh, very nice.
And yeah, you know, that's just a kind of, that's kind of my serenity prayer when it feels rote to me. Mm-hmm. I can go to, but thank you. I really appreciate that you brought up prayer, because it's something I have thought of.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
So I'm reminded that someone who was in a workshop with me years ago came up with her own third step prayer, Buddhist third step prayer, which I put, it's in the appendix of my workbook. I can dig it up too. So while I'm listening, I'll try to dig it up for you and put it in the chat.
I can do that, Kevin.
Okay. Do you have it? I mean,
yeah.
Okay. But you'll have to type it. Whereas I have it.
Oh, you have
it as a Word document since I wrote the book. Okay. Easy to copy and paste. Kevin in MN, I believe that's not the Majjhima Nikaya. That's Minnesota, right?
Kevin, you're muted.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, actually, MN is a new chant.
Yes, very nice.
Anyway, it's Minnesota, yes. And a little bit of background. 40 years ago, I was chanting Nichiren Buddhist, okay?
Yeah.
And you know, about 3 years, I was pretty active. And as most people well know, there are so many different sects of Buddhism and schools of Buddhism. And what sutra do you focus on and who do you follow and all that kind of stuff. But I see a real big division between what I was doing then and what I guess I kind of believed over the last 40 years and what goes on now, Kevin, in your Sangha and in Recovery Dharma, which I'm very active in. This goal of like peace and being at ease and everything like that. Whereas with the chanting Buddhism that I was involved in, it was more dynamic. It was more like get in tune with the universe. Mm-hmm. Be one of those gears that mesh with the bigger picture. And to me, that all kind of made sense. I'm not a very serene person to begin with. And, you know, I wonder how, what are your comments on that? I mean, you know, being, you know, actively involved and trying to get into that rhythm, you know, whether that's through chanting or good works or group prayer or whatever, as opposed to this flip side, contemplative, inward looking, you know, kind of like, whoa, I'm going to chill.
Yeah, I mean,
I think there's a question there.
Yeah, I'll say that it's not something that would work for me because I'm too much of a greed and aversive version individual. So it'd be very hard for me to use a practice like that skillfully. I think it's possible to use it skillfully, but you know, Nichiren Buddhism, from a Theravadan viewpoint, it seems pretty far away from the early teachings. It's, you know, it very much came out of a, you know, a particular individual in Japan, as you probably know, and was kind of meant to be to speak to people who weren't going to sort of, for various reasons, not going to be contemplatives. And it was sort of offering them another approach. But it's just kind of at the other end of the spectrum from Theravadan Buddhism. So I don't have anything very helpful to say about it.
Well, I mean, I guess that's kind of my question. I mean, it's a spectrum or an A-B choice. And the Nichiren Buddhist would argue that the sutra that Nichiren follows is, one of the Gautama's one of his final type sutras, you know. Why would he wait 40 years to get to that conclusion, if you will?
Yeah, well, that's fiction. There are the Mahayana sutras, like the Lotus and Diamond Sutra, Heart Sutra, do not come from the Buddha. That doesn't mean they aren't Buddhist, you know, but they don't come from the Buddha. You know, that's kind of mythology. I should say mythology to make it more respectful, because I don't want to be disrespectful. I think, you know, what's clear is that chanting and mantra are longstanding aspects of Buddhist practice. going back to the original Buddhism. And the question really becomes what the intention is behind them. And it's something I actually have never really talked to my monastic teachers about. And it's come up for me recently to kind of ask them how they view the intention behind chanting. Because the original intention behind chanting the suttas was merely to preserve them, since they were not written down. It was a way of just transmitting and preserving the teachings. But eventually it became ritualized. And as you know, in things like the Nichiren tradition, and indeed in the the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, I know one of you can remind me their tradition that chants
Pure Land.
Yeah, Pure Land. Thank you. The Pure Land tradition also uses chanting for more, I could say, more worldly purposes somewhat. And so, you know, that's just kind of part of the evolution of the tradition. It's something you can, I'm sure, has been written about by more knowledgeable people than I. If I would, you know, look at what people say about it, I bet there's a book just on the history of chanting. But thank you for bringing it up.
Thank you for your answer, Bill.
Okay, I don't know if it's, I'm trying to avoid trouble here. Sherry, another person in Minnesota, right?
Yep, Duluth, Minnesota.
Yeah, see, there you go. You guys are...
my neighbor.
I just wanted to thank you for your thoughts about how to keep it simple, because I can so easily get caught up in some book I'm reading and try and intellectualize everything and try and know the meaning behind it all. And, right. and instead of just letting it, and then taking that little bit of knowledge that I've learned and just letting it be and using it in my life and to listen to my heart, not my head. You know, listen to that part of me that I know that is the knowing part that doesn't come out of my head.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to thank you for that little reminder of that. And yeah. I'll pass.
Yeah, thank you. So before we get to the last comment, I something that just occurred to me that people might find interesting, and particularly Kevin in Minnesota. If you're interested in the history of Buddhism, there's a great book called How the Swans Came to the Lake, which it actually is kind of about how, ultimately it's about how Buddhism came to the West. But it's got a bunch of chapters that cover all the traditions, and it goes back to the earliest teachings and then got the different traditions and how they arose and the kind of history of them. Stephen Batch, that's written by... Rick is dead now. What's his name? Rick Fields. Yeah, he was the editor of Yoga Journal. And Stephen Batchelor also has a book that's about the history of Buddhism and how it came to Europe. So that, and there's more than about Asian, Central Asian Buddhism there. Can't remember the title of that one. Awakening of the West, perhaps something like that. And that's where I've learned most of what I know about that stuff. So and if you're into history, it's really fun, you know, really interesting stuff. So Steve, for the last person, because I've got to go after this.
Thank you, Kevin. Welcome home.
Thank you.
I just wanted to, I'll make it quick. I know we're short on time, but I have to share an experience I had Sunday morning, and I attribute that experience to that step 11 and all the writing and the stuff that you touched on this morning. It really struck me, and I've gone back into A Burning Desire, and I'm reading it now for the third time, because I'm just one of those people that, somewhat agnostic, I'm trying to figure it out too. You know, what is God? What is higher power? But I've been in this really dark place this last year, experiencing a lot of fear, And I've allowed my cravings to throw me into my food addiction, and I put on quite a bit of weight, and I just was getting so, just feeling a lot of worry and being scared. How am I going to get out of this? So I just sat down and told myself all last week when I was contemplating, why don't you just let whatever's going to happen, happen? Why don't you don't have to figure it out. You don't have to say, you know, what is God for you? What is higher power? And Sunday morning, I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning when my usual time I arise. And I have to tell you, I experienced complete, 100% complete serenity. I don't know how it happened. I don't know why it happened. I don't understand it. All I know is that something in my head just said, you're going to be okay. And it was like, I had this most peaceful moment that I've ever had in my life. I've never experienced anything like it. And I thought, well, maybe this is higher power. You know, maybe this is the work I'm doing. But all I know is that I know I'm going to be okay. And I'm abstinent now, and I'm just living life and enjoying it. And this past few days has just been blissful. I don't know. Sometimes I don't understand what my mind does, but you know, these readings, these readings just really speak to me. So thank you. And I'm just glad you're here.
Just sometimes you don't understand what your mind does. That's better than me.
Okay, all the time.
that's wonderful, Steve. And I do think that we have these moments when the work blossoms, unfolds. It's not permanent, you know, but we get a taste of it. And when we get a taste of it, that gives us more faith, both in ourselves and in the path. And we don't have to figure it out what that is. I mean, my view, I'll tell you what I think it is, but I am trying to figure it out. You know, it's the showing up. It's the persistence of showing up one day at a time, doing the work consistently, being on the path, being committed, getting your and partly, you know, your mind is becoming inclined towards that. That, you know, you're filling your head with those thoughts and those intentions and those experiences to the point where they start to kind of crowd out the negativity. And you know, it's always going to be a, you know, a little bit of a, you know, vacillation there.
It's just a wonderful feeling of impermanence, you know, and I know, and now I know I'm not worried about everything. It just has kind of left me. It's all going to be okay.
Yeah. Lovely. Well, that's a great note to end on. It's all going to be okay. Thank you, Steve. Thanks, everybody. Be well. And,